watched by even more eyes. One voice said loud enough for him to hear, "He must be a passenger." "No, he's an officer," said a second voice. "What's the difference?" Several men laughed. Once he was back in his cabin, he undressed and climbed onto the thin wooden bunk. He tried to find a comfortable position without falling out or rolling into the wall as the ship swayed from side to side as well as lurching up and down. He didn't even have a washbasin to be sick in or a porthole to be sick out of. As he lay awake, his thoughts turned to Emma. He wondered if she was still in Scotland or had returned to the manor house, or perhaps she'd already taken up residence at Oxford. Would Giles be wondering where he was, or had Sir Walter told him he'd gone to sea and would be joining the Resolution the moment he landed back in Bristol? And would his mother be wondering where he could be? Perhaps he should have broken her golden rule and interrupted her at work. Finally, he thought about old Jack, and suddenly felt guilty when he realized he wouldn't be back in time for his funeral. What Harry couldn't know was that his own funeral would take place before old Jack's. Chapter 52. Harry was woken by the sound of four bells. He leapt up, hitting his head on the ceiling, threw on his clothes, squeezed into the corridor, shot up the stairwell, ran across the deck, and bounded up the steps onto the bridge. "Sorry I'm late, sir. I must have overslept."
"You don't have to call me sir when we're on our own," said Bradshaw. "The name's Tom, and as a matter of fact, you're over an hour early. The skipper obviously forgot to tell you it's 7 bells for the breakfast watch and 4 for the 6 o'clock watch. But as you're here, why don't you take over the wheel while I take a leak?"
The shock for Harry was to realize that Bradshaw wasn't joking.
"Just be sure the arrow on the compass is always pointing south-southwest, then you can't go far wrong," he added, his American accent sounding more pronounced.
Harry took the wheel with both hands and stared intently at the little black arrow as he tried to keep the ship ploughing through the waves in a straight line. When he looked back at the wake, he saw that the neat straight line Bradshaw had achieved with such apparent ease had been replaced by the sort of curves more associated with May West. Although Bradshaw was only away for a few minutes, Harry had rarely been more pleased to see anyone when he returned. Bradshaw took over, and the uninterrupted straight line quickly reappeared, although he only had one hand on the wheel.
"Remember, you're handling a lady," said Bradshaw. "You don't cling on to her, but gently caress her. If you can manage that, she'll stay on the straight and narrow. Now try again, while I plot our 7 bells position on the daily chart."
When 1 bell rang 25 minutes later, and the captain appeared on the bridge to relieve Bradshaw, Harry's line in the ocean may not have been entirely straight, but at least it no longer appeared as if the ship was being steered by a drunken sailor. At breakfast, Harry was introduced to a man who could only have been first engineer. Jim Patterson's ghostly complexion made him look as if he'd spent most of his life below decks, and his paunch suggested he spent the rest of the time eating. Unlike Bradshaw, he never stopped talking, and it quickly became clear to Harry that he and the skipper were old friends. The Chinaman appeared, carrying 3 plates that could have been cleaner. Harry avoided the greasy bacon and fried tomatoes in favor of a piece of burnt toast and an apple.
"Why don't you spend the rest of the morning finding your way around the ship, Mr. Clifton?" suggested the captain after the plates had been cleared away. "You could even join Mr. Patterson in the engine room and see how many minutes you survive down there."
Patterson burst out laughing, grabbed the last 2 pieces of toast, and said,
"If you think these are burnt, wait until you spend a few minutes with me."
Like a cat that has been left alone in a new house, Harry began stalking around the outside of the deck as he tried to become familiar with his new kingdom. He knew the ship was 475 feet long with a 56-foot beam, and its top speed was 15 knots. But he'd had no idea there would be so many nooks and crannies that undoubtedly served some purpose which, given time, he would learn. Harry also noticed there wasn't any part of the deck the captain couldn't keep a watchful eye on from the bridge, so there was no chance of escape for an idle seaman. Harry took the stairwell down to the middle deck. The aft section consisted of the officers' quarters, amidships was the galley, and forward was a large open area of slung hammocks. How anyone could possibly sleep in one of those was beyond him. Then he noticed half a dozen sailors, who must have come off the dog watch, swaying gently from side to side with the rhythm of the ship, and sleeping contentedly. A narrow steel stairwell led down to the lower deck, where the wooden crates that held the 144 Raleigh bicycles, 1,000 cotton dresses, and 2 tons of potatoes were all safely secured, and wouldn't be opened until after the ship docked in Cuba. Finally, he descended a narrow ladder that led to the boiler room and Mr. Patterson's domain. He heaved open the heavy metal hatch and, like Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, marched boldly into the fiery furnace. He stood and watched as half a dozen squat, muscle-bound men, their vests soiled with black dust, sweat pouring down their backs, shoveled coal into 2 gaping mouths that needed to be fed more than 4 meals a day. As Captain Havens had predicted, it was only a few minutes before Harry had to stagger back into the corridor, sweating and gasping for breath. It was some time before he recovered enough to make his way back up onto the deck, where he fell on his knees and gulped in the fresh air. He could only wonder how those men could survive in such conditions and be expected to carry out 3 2-hour shifts a day, 7 days a week. Once Harry had recovered, he made his way back up to the bridge, armed with 100 questions, from which star in the plough points to the North Star, to how many nautical miles the ship could average per day, to how many tons of coal were required for... The captain happily answered them all, without once appearing exasperated by the young fourth officer's unquenchable thirst for knowledge. In fact, Captain Havens remarked to Mr. Bradshaw during Harry's break that what impressed him most about the lad was that he never asked the same question twice. During the next few days, Harry learnt how to check the compass against the dotted line on the chart, how to gauge wind direction by watching seagulls, and how to take the ship through the trough of a wave and still maintain a constant course. By the end of the first week, he was allowed to take over the wheel whenever an officer took a meal break. By night, the captain taught him the names of the stars, which, he pointed out, were every bit as reliable as a compass. But he confessed his knowledge was limited to the northern hemisphere, as the Devonian had never crossed the equator in all her 26 years on the high seas. After 10 days at sea, the captain was almost hoping for a storm, not only to stop the endless questions, but also to see if there was anything that could throw this young man off his stride. Jim Patterson had already warned him that Mr. Clifton had survived for an hour in the boiler room that morning and was determined to complete a full shift before they docked in Cuba. "At least you're spared his endless questions down there," remarked the captain. "This week," responded the chief engineer. Captain Havens wondered if a time would come when he learnt something from his fourth officer. It happened on the 12th day of the voyage, just after Harry had completed his first 2-hour shift in the boiler room. "Did you know that Mr. Patterson collects stamps, sir?" Harry asked.
"Yes, I did," replied the captain confidently.
"And that his collection now numbers over 4,000, including an unperforated penny black and a South African triangular Cape of Good Hope?"
"Yes, I did," repeated the captain.
"And that the collection is now worth more than his home in Mablethorpe?"
"It's only a cottage, damn it," said the captain, trying to hold his own. And before Harry could ask his next question, he added, I'd be more interested if you could find out as much about Tom Bradshaw as you seem to have wormed out of my chief engineer. Because frankly, Harry, I know more about you after 12 days than I do about my third officer after 3 years, and until now I'd never thought of Americans as being a reserved race."
The more Harry thought about the captain's observation, the more he realized just how little he too knew about Tom, despite having spent many hours with him on the bridge. He had no idea if the man had any brothers or sisters, what his father did for a living, where his parents lived, or whether he even had a girlfriend. And only his accent gave away the fact that he was an American, because Harry didn't know which town or even state he hailed from. 7 bells rang.
"Would you take over the wheel, Mr. Clifton?" said the captain, "while I join Mr. Patterson and Mr. Bradshaw for dinner. Don't hesitate to let me know if you spot anything," he added as he left the bridge, "especially if it's bigger than we are."
"Aye, aye, sir," said Harry, delighted to be left in charge, even if it was only for 40 minutes, although those 40 minutes were being extended each day. It was when Harry asked him how many more days it would be before they reached Cuba that Captain Havens realized the precocious youth was already bored. He was beginning to feel some sympathy for the captain of HMS Resolution, who had no idea what he was letting himself in for. Harry had recently been taking over the wheel after dinner, so that the other officers could enjoy a few hands of gin rummy before returning to the bridge. And whenever the Chinaman took up Harry's mug of tea now, it was always piping hot, with the requested one lump of sugar. Mr. Patterson was heard to remark to the captain one evening that should Mr. Clifton decide to take over the ship before they got back to Bristol, he wasn't sure who he'd side with.
"Are you thinking of inciting a mutiny, Jim?" asked Havens as he poured his chief engineer another tot of rum. "No, but I must warn you, Skipper, that the young Turk has already reorganized the shifts in the boiler room, so I know whose side my lads would be on." "Then the least we can do," said Havens, pouring himself a glass of rum, "is order the flag officer to send a message to the Resolution, warning them what they'll be up against."
"But we don't have a flag officer," said Patterson.
"Then we'll have to clap the lad in irons," said the captain.
"Good idea, Skipper. It's just a shame we don't have any irons."
"More's the pity. Remind me to pick some up as soon as we get back to Bristol.
But you seem to have forgotten Clifton's leaving us to join the Resolution the moment we dock," Patterson said.
The captain swallowed a mouthful of rum before repeating, "More's the pity." Chapter 53. Harry reported to the bridge a few minutes before 7 bells to relieve Mr. Bradshaw, so he could go below and join the captain for dinner. The length of time Tom left him in charge of the bridge was becoming longer and longer with each watch, but Harry never complained, because he enjoyed the illusion that for an hour a day the ship was under his command. He checked the arrow on the compass and steered the course that had been set by the captain. He had even been entrusted with entering their position on the chart and writing up the daily log before he came off duty. As Harry stood alone on the bridge, a full moon, a calm sea, and 1,000 miles of ocean ahead of him, his thoughts drifted back to England. He wondered what Emma was doing at that moment. Emma was sitting in her room at Somerville College, Oxford, tuning her radio to the home service so she could hear Mr. Neville Chamberlain address the nation.
"This is the BBC in London. You will now hear a statement from the Prime Minister. I am speaking to you from the Cabinet Room, 10 Downing Street. This morning, the British ambassador in Berlin handed the German government a final note stating that unless we heard from them by 11 o'clock, that they were prepared at once to withdraw their troops from Poland, a state of war would exist between us. I have to tell you now that no such undertaking has been received, and that consequently this country is at war with Germany."
But as the Devonian's radio was unable to pick up the BBC, Everyone on board went about their business as if it was a normal day. Harry was still thinking about Emma when the first one shot past the bow. He wasn't sure what he should do. He was loath to disturb the captain during dinner for fear of being reprimanded for wasting his time. Harry was wide awake when he saw the second one, and this time he had no doubt what it was. Harry watched as the long, slender, shiny object slithered below the surface towards the bow of the ship. He instinctively swung the wheel to starboard, but the ship veered to port. It wasn't quite what he'd intended, but the mistake gave him enough time to raise the alarm because the object shot past the bow, missing the ship by several yards. This time he didn't hesitate and jammed the palm of his hand on the klaxon, which immediately emitted a loud blast. Moments later, Mr. Bradshaw appeared on deck and began racing towards the bridge, closely followed by the captain pulling on his jacket. One by one, the rest of the crew came rushing out of the bowels of the ship and headed straight for their stations, assuming it must be an unscheduled fire drill. "What's the problem, Mr. Clifton?" asked Captain Havens calmly as he stepped onto the bridge.
"I think I saw a torpedo, sir, but as I've never seen one before, I can't be sure."
"Could it have been a dolphin enjoying our leftovers?" suggested the captain.
"No, sir, it wasn't a dolphin."
"I've never seen a torpedo either," Havens admitted as he took over the wheel. "Which direction was it coming from?"
"Nor-nor-east."
"Mr. Bradshaw," said the captain, "all crew to emergency stations and prepare to lower the lifeboats on my command."
"Aye, aye, sir," said Bradshaw, who slid down the railings onto the deck and immediately began to organize the crew.
"Mr. Clifton, keep your eyes peeled and tell me the moment you spot anything."
Harry grabbed the binoculars and began a slow sweep of the ocean. At the same time, the captain bellowed down the voice pipe.
"All engines reverse, Mr. Patterson. All engines reverse and stand by for further orders."
"Aye, aye, sir,"
said a startled chief engineer, who hadn't heard that order since 1918. "Another one," said Harry, "nor-nor-east, coming directly towards us."
"I see it," said the captain.
He swung the wheel to the left, and the torpedo missed them by only a few feet. He knew he was unlikely to pull off that trick again.
"You were right, Mr. Clifton. That wasn't a dolphin," said Havens matter-of-factly.
Under his breath, he added, "We must be at war. The enemy has torpedoes, and all I've got is 144 Raleigh bicycles, a few sacks of potatoes, and some cotton dresses." Harry kept his eyes peeled. The captain remained so calm that Harry felt almost no sense of danger.
"Number four, coming directly at us, sir," he said. "Nor-nor-east again."
Havens gamely tried to maneuver the old lady one more time, but she didn't respond quickly enough to his unwelcome advances, and the torpedo ripped into the ship's bow. A few minutes later, Mr. Patterson reported that a fire had broken out below the waterline, and that his men were finding it impossible to douse the flames with the ship's primitive foam hoses. The captain didn't need to be told that he was facing a hopeless task.
"Mr. Bradshaw, prepare to abandon ship. All crew to stand by the lifeboats and await further orders."
"Aye, aye, sir,"
shouted Bradshaw from the deck.
Havens bellowed down the voice pipe. "Mr. Patterson, get yourself and your men out of there immediately, and I mean immediately, and report to the lifeboats. We're on our way, skipper."
"Another one, sir," said Harry. "Nor-nor-west, heading towards the starboard side, amidships."
The captain swung the wheel once again, but he knew this time he would not be able to ride the punch. Seconds later, the torpedo ripped into the ship, which began to list to one side.
"Abandon ship!" shouted Havens, reaching for the tannoy. "Abandon ship!" he repeated several times, before he turned to Harry, who was still scanning the sea through his binoculars. "Make your way to the nearest lifeboat, Mr. Clifton, and sharpish. There's no point in anyone remaining on the bridge."
"Aye, aye, sir," said Harry.
"Captain!" came a voice from the engine room. "Number four hold is jammed. I'm trapped below deck along with five of my men." "We're on our way, Mr. Patterson. We'll have you out of there in no time.
Change of plan, Mr. Clifton. Follow me."
The captain shot down the stairs, his feet barely touching the steps, with Harry just inches behind him.
Mr. Bradshaw!" shouted the captain as he dodged in and out of the oil-fed, lapping flames which had reached the upper deck. "Get the man in the lifeboat, sharpish, and abandon ship."
"Aye, aye, sir," said Bradshaw, who was clinging onto the ship's railings.
"I need an oar, and make sure you have one lifeboat on standby, ready to take Mr. Patterson and his men from the boiler room."
Bradshaw grabbed an oar from one of the lifeboats, and with the help of another seaman, managed to pass it to the captain. Harry and the skipper took one end each and stumbled along the deck towards number four hold. Harry was puzzled what use an oar could possibly be against torpedoes, but this wasn't the time to be asking questions. The captain charged on past the Chinaman, who was on his knees, head bowed, praying to his god.
"Get yourself into the lifeboat now, you stupid bugger!" shouted Havens.
Mr. Liu rose unsteadily to his feet, but didn't move. As Harry staggered past, he shoved the man in the direction of the third officer, causing Mr. Liu to topple forwards and almost fall into Mr. Bradshaw's arms. When the captain reached the hatch above number four hold, he wedged the thin end of the oar into an arched hook, jumped up, and threw all his weight onto the blade. Harry quickly joined him, and together they managed to lever up the massive iron plate until there was a gap of about a foot.
"You pull the men out, Mr. Clifton, while I try to keep the hatch open," said Havens, as two hands appeared through the gap.
Harry let go of the oar, fell to his knees, and crawled towards the open hatch. As he grabbed the man's shoulders, a wave of water swept over him and into the hold. He yanked the seaman out and shouted at him to report straight to the lifeboats. The second man was more agile and managed to pull himself out without Harry's assistance, while the third was in such a blind panic that he shot through the hole and banged his head on the hatch lid before staggering off after his shipmates. The next two followed in quick succession and scrambled on their hands and knees in the direction of the last remaining lifeboat. Harry waited for the chief engineer to appear, but there was no sign of him. The ship lurched further over, and Harry had to cling to the deck to stop himself falling headfirst into the hold. He peered down into the darkness and spotted an outstretched hand. He put his head through the hole and leaned down as far as he could without falling in, but couldn't quite reach the second officer's fingers. Mr. Patterson tried several times to jump up, but with each attempt his efforts were hampered as more water poured in on top of him. Captain Havens could see what the problem was, but couldn't come to their assistance, because if he let go of the oar, the hatch lid would come crashing down on Harry. Patterson, who was now up to his knees in water, shouted,
"For God's sake, you two! Get yourselves into the lifeboats before it's too late!" "Not a chance," said the captain. "Mr. Clifton, get yourself down there and push the bastard up, then you can follow."
Harry didn't hesitate. He lowered himself backwards, feet first, into the hold, gripping onto the ledge with his fingertips. Finally, he let go and dropped into the darkness. The sloshing, oily, freezing water broke his fall, and once he'd regained his balance, he gripped the sides, lowered himself down into the water, and said,
"Climb onto my shoulders, sir, and you should be able to reach."
The chief engineer obeyed the fourth officer. But when he stretched up, he was still a few inches short of the deck. Harry used every ounce of strength in his body to push Patterson further up until he was able to reach the rim of the hatch and cling on by the tips of his fingers. Water was now pouring into the hold as the ship listed further and further over. Harry placed a hand under each of Mr. Patterson's buttocks and began to press like a weightlifter until the chief engineer's head appeared above the deck.
"Good to see you, Jim," grunted the captain, as he continued to place every ounce of his weight onto the oar.
"You too, Arnold," replied the chief engineer as he pulled himself slowly out of the hold. It was at that moment the last torpedo hit the sinking ship. The oar snapped in half, and the iron hatch lid came crashing down on the chief engineer. Like the axe of a medieval executioner, with one slice it cleanly severed his head and slammed shut. Patterson's body fell back into the hold, landing in the water next to Harry. Harry thanked God he couldn't see Mr. Patterson in the darkness that now surrounded him. At least the water had stopped flooding in, even if it meant there was now no escape. As the Devonian began to keel over, Harry assumed the captain must also have been killed, or he surely would have been banging on the hatch, trying to find some way of getting him out. As he slumped down into the water, Harry thought how ironic it was that he should go to his grave like his father, entombed in the hollow bottom of a ship. He clung to the side of the hold in one final effort to cheat death. As he waited for the water to rise inch by inch above his shoulders, his neck, his head, myriad faces flashed before him. Strange thoughts take over when you know you only have a few moments left to live. At least his death would solve problems for so many people he loved. Emma would be released from her pledge to forsake all others for the rest of her days. Sir Walter would no longer have to worry about the implications of his father's will. In time, Giles would inherit the family title and all his father's worldly goods. Even Hugo Barrington might survive, now that it would no longer be necessary for him to prove he wasn't Harry's father. Only his dear mother. Suddenly there was an almighty explosion. The Devonian split in two, and seconds later both halves reared up like a startled horse before the broken ship unceremoniously sank to the bottom of the ocean. The captain of the U-boat watched through his periscope until the Devonian had disappeared below the waves, leaving in its wake 1,000 brightly coloured cotton dresses and countless bodies bobbing up and down in the sea, surrounded by potatoes. Chapter 54. "Can you tell me your name?" Harry looked up at the nurse, but couldn't move his lips. "Can you hear me?" she asked. Another American accent. Harry managed a faint nod, and she smiled. He heard a door opening, and although he couldn't see who had entered the sick bay, the nurse left him immediately, so it had to be someone in authority. Even if he couldn't see them, he could hear what they were saying. It made him feel like an eavesdropper. "Good evening, Nurse Craven," said an older man's voice. "Good evening, Dr. Wallace," she replied. "How are our two patients?" "One showing definite signs of improvement, the others still unconscious." So at least two of us survived, thought Harry. He wanted to cheer, but although his lips moved, no words came out. "And we still have no idea who they are." "No, but Captain Parker came in earlier to see how they were, and when I showed him what was left of their uniforms, he wasn't in much doubt they were both officers." Harry's heart leapt at the thought that Captain Havens might have survived. He heard the doctor walk over to the other bed, but he couldn't turn his head to see who was lying there. A few moments later he heard, "Poor devil. I'll be surprised if he survives the night." "Then you obviously don't know Captain Havens," Harry wanted to tell him, "because you won't kill him off that easily." The doctor returned to Harry's bedside and began to examine him. Harry could just make out a middle-aged man with a serious, thoughtful face. Once Dr. Wallace had finished his examination, he turned away and whispered to the nurse, "I feel a lot more hopeful about this one, although the odds are still no better than 50-50 after what he's been through." "Keep fighting, young man," he said, turning to face Harry, though he couldn't be sure if the patient could hear him. "We're going to do everything in our power to keep you alive." Harry wanted to thank him, but all he could manage was another slight nod before the doctor walked away. "If either of them should die during the night," he heard the doctor whisper to the nurse, "are you familiar with the correct procedure?" "Yes, doctor. The captain is to be informed immediately, and the body is to be taken down to the morgue." Harry wanted to ask how many of his shipmates were already there.
"And I'd also like to be kept informed," added Wallace, "even if I've turned in for the night."
"Of course, Doctor. Can I ask what the captain has decided to do with those poor devils who were already dead when we pulled them out of the water?"
"He's given an order that, as they were all sailors, they are to be buried at sea at first light tomorrow morning."
"Why so early?"
"He doesn't want the passengers to realize just how many lives were lost last night," the doctor added as he walked away. Harry heard a door open. "Good night, nurse."
"Good night, doctor,"
the nurse replied, and the door closed. Nurse Craven walked back and sat down by Harry's bedside.
"I don't give a damn about the odds," she said. "You're going to live."
Harry looked up at a nurse who was hidden behind her starched white uniform and white cap, but even so, he couldn't miss the burning conviction in her eyes. When Harry next woke, the room was in darkness apart from a glimmer of light in the far corner, probably from another room. His first thought was of Captain Havens fighting for his life in the next bed. He prayed that he would survive, and they'd be able to return to England together when the captain would retire, and Harry could sign up with any Royal Navy vessel Sir Walter could get him on. His thoughts turned to Emma once again, and how his death would have solved so many problems for the Barrington family that would now return to haunt them. Harry heard the door open again, and someone with an unfamiliar step walked into the sick bay. Although he couldn't see who it was, the sound of their shoes suggested two things. It was a man, and he knew where he was going. Another door opened on the far side of the room, and the light became brighter. "Hi, Kristen," said a man's voice.
"Hello, Richard," came back the nurse's reply.
"You're late," she said, teasing, not angry.
"Sorry, honey. All the officers had to remain on the bridge until the search for survivors was finally abandoned."
The door closed, and the light softened once more. Harry had no way of knowing how much time had passed before the door opened again. Half an hour perhaps, and he heard their voices.
"Your tie's not straight," said the nurse.
"That won't do," the man replied. "Someone might figure out what we've been up to." She laughed as he began walking towards the door.
Suddenly he stopped. "Who are these two?"
"Mr. A and Mr. B, the only survivors from last night's rescue operation."
"I'm Mr. C," Harry wanted to tell her as they walked towards his bed.
Harry closed his eyes. He didn't want them to think he'd been listening to their conversation. She took his pulse.
"I think Mr. B is getting stronger by the hour. You know, I can't bear the thought of not saving at least one of them."
She left Harry and walked over to the other bed. Harry opened his eyes and turned his head slightly to see a tall young man in a smart white dress uniform with gold epaulets. Without warning, Nurse Craven began to sob. The young man placed an arm gently around her shoulder and tried to comfort her.
"No, no," Harry wanted to shout. "Captain Havens can't die. We're going back to England together."
"What's the procedure in these circumstances?" asked the young officer, sounding rather formal.
"I have to inform the captain immediately and then wake Dr. Wallace. Once all the papers have been signed and clearance has been authorized, the body will be taken down to the morgue and prepared for tomorrow's burial service."
"No, no, no," Harry shouted, but neither of them heard him.
"I pray to whatever God," continued the nurse, "that America doesn't become involved in this war."
"That's never going to happen, honey," said the young officer. "Roosevelt's far too canny to get himself involved in another European war."
"That's what the politician said last time," Kristen reminded him.
"Hey, what's brought this on?" he sounded concerned.
"Mr. A was about the same age as you," she said. Perhaps he also had a fiancée back home. Harry realized that it wasn't Captain Havens in the next bed, but Tom Bradshaw. That was when he made the decision. When Harry woke again, he could hear voices coming from the next room. Moments later, Dr. Wallace and Nurse Craven walked into the sick bay. "It must have been heart-wrenching," said the nurse.
"It wasn't at all pleasant," admitted the doctor. "Somehow it was made worse because they all went to their graves nameless. Although I had to agree with the captain, that's the way a sailor would have wanted to be buried."
"Any news from the other ship?" asked the nurse.
"Yes, they've done a little better than us. 11 dead, but 3 survivors, a Chinaman and 2 Englishmen."
Harry wondered if it was possible that one of the Englishmen might be Captain Havens. The doctor bent down and unbuttoned Harry's pajama top. He placed a cold stethoscope on several parts of his chest and listened carefully. Then the nurse placed a thermometer in Harry's mouth. "His temperature is well down, doctor," said the nurse, after she had checked the vein of mercury.
"Excellent. You might try giving him some thin soup."
"Yes, of course. Will you need my help with any of the passengers?"
"No, thank you, nurse. Your most important job is to make sure this one survives. I'll see you in a couple of hours."
Once the door had closed, the nurse returned to Harry's bedside. She sat down and smiled. "Can you see me?" she asked. Harry nodded. "Can you tell me your name?"
"Tom Bradshaw," he replied.
Chapter 55.
"Tom," said Dr. Wallace, once he'd completed his examination of Harry, "I wonder if you can tell me the name of your fellow officer who died last night. I'd like to write to his mother, or his wife, if he had one."
"His name was Harry Clifton," said Harry, his voice barely audible. "He wasn't married, but I know his mother quite well. I planned to write to her myself."
"That's good of you," said Wallace, "but I'd still like to send her a letter. Do you have her address?"
"Yes, I do," said Harry, "but it might be kinder if she heard from me first, and not from a complete stranger," he suggested.
"If you think so," said Wallace, not sounding at all sure.
"Yes, I do," said Harry, a little more firmly this time. "You can always post my letter when the Kansas Star returns to Bristol. That's assuming the captain is still planning to sail back to England, now we're at war with Germany."
"We are not at war with Germany," said Wallace.
"No, of course we're not," said Harry, quickly correcting himself, "and let's hope it never comes to that."
"Agreed," said Wallace. "But that won't stop the Kansas Star making the return journey. There are still hundreds of Americans stranded in England with no other way of getting home."
"Isn't that a bit of a risk?" asked Harry, "especially considering what we've just been through."
"No, I don't think so," said Wallace. "The last thing the Germans will want to do is sink an American passenger ship, which would be sure to drag us into the conflict. I suggest you get some sleep, Tom, because I'm hoping that tomorrow the nurse will be able to take you for a turn around the deck. Only one lap to begin with," he emphasized.
Harry closed his eyes, but made no attempt to sleep as he began to think about the decision he'd made and how many lives it would affect. By taking Tom Bradshaw's identity, he had allowed himself a little breathing space to consider his future. Once they learnt that Harry Clifton had been killed at sea, Sir Walter and the rest of the Barrington family would be released from any obligations they might have felt bound by, and Emma would be free to begin a new life.
a decision he felt old Jack would have approved of, although the full implications hadn't yet sunk in. However, the resurrection of Tom Bradshaw would undoubtedly create its own problems, and he would have to remain constantly on his guard. It didn't help that he knew almost nothing about Bradshaw, so that whenever Nurse Craven asked him about his past, he either had to make something up or change the subject. Bradshaw had proved very adept at deflecting any questions he didn't wish to answer, and had clearly been a loner. He hadn't set foot in his own country for at least 3 years, possibly more, so his family would have no way of knowing of his imminent return. As soon as the Kansas Star arrived in New York, Harry planned to sail back to England on the first available ship. His greatest dilemma was how to prevent his mother from being put through any unnecessary suffering by thinking she'd lost her only son. Dr. Wallace had gone some way to solving that particular problem when he promised to post a letter to Maisie the moment he arrived back in England. But Harry still had to write that letter. He had spent hours going over the text in his mind, so that by the time he'd recovered enough to commit his thoughts to paper, he almost knew the script by heart. New York, September the 8th, 1939. My dearest mother, I have done everything in my power to make sure you receive this letter before anyone can tell you I was killed at sea. As the date on this letter shows, I did not die when the Devonian was sunk on September the 4th. In fact, I was plucked out of the sea by an American ship and am very much alive. However, an opportunity arose for me to assume another man's identity, and I did so, in the hope it would release both you and the Barrington family from the many problems I seem to have unwittingly caused over the years. It is important that you realize my love for Emma has in no way diminished, far from it. But I do not feel I have the right to expect her to spend the rest of her life clinging on to the vain hope that at some time in the future I might be able to prove that Arthur Clifton and not Hugo Barrington was my father. This way, she can at least consider a future with someone else. I envy that man. I plan to return to England in the near future. Should you receive any communication from a Tom Bradshaw, it will be from me. I will be in touch with you the moment I set foot in England. But in the meantime, I must beg you to keep my secret as steadfastly as you kept your own for so many years. Your loving son, Harry. He read the letter several times before placing it in an envelope marked Strictly Private and Confidential. He addressed it to Mrs. Arthur Clifton, 27 Stillhouse Lane, Bristol. The following morning, he handed the letter over to Dr. Wallace. "Do you think you're ready to try a short walk around the deck?" asked Kristin. "Sure am," Harry replied, trying out one of the expressions he'd heard her boyfriend use, although he still found it unnatural to add the word honey. During those long hours he'd spent in bed, Harry had listened carefully to Dr. Wallace, and whenever he was alone, he tried to imitate his accent, which he'd heard Kristin describe to Richard as East Coast. Harry was thankful for the hours he'd spent with Dr. Paget, learning voice skills that he'd assumed would only be of use on stage. He was on stage. However, he still had the problem of how to deal with Kristin's innocent curiosity about his family background and upbringing. He was assisted by a novel by Horatio Alger and another by Thornton Wilder, the only two books that had been left behind in the sick bay. From these, he was able to conjure up a fictional family who hailed from Bridgeport, Connecticut. They consisted of a father, who was a small-town bank manager with Connecticut Trust and Savings, a mother, who was a dutiful homemaker and had once come second in the town's annual beauty pageant, and an older sister, Sally, who was happily married to Jake, who ran the local hardware store. He smiled to himself when he recalled Dr. Paget's remark that, with his imagination, he was more likely to end up a writer than an actor. Harry placed his feet tentatively on the floor and, with Kristin's help, pulled himself slowly up. Once he'd put on a dressing gown, he took her by the arm and made his way unsteadily towards the door, up a flight of steps, and out onto the deck.
"How long is it since you've been home?"
asked Kristin, as they began their slow progress around the deck. Harry always tried to stick to the little he actually knew about Bradshaw, adding a few snippets from the life of his fictitious family.
"Just over 3 years," he said. "My family never complain, because they knew I wanted to go to sea from an early age."
"But how did you come to be serving on a British ship?"
"Damn good question," thought Harry. He only wished he knew the answer. He stumbled to give himself a little more time to come up with a convincing reply. Kristin bent down to assist him. "I'm fine," he said, once he'd taken Kristin's arm again. Then he began to sneeze repeatedly.
"Perhaps it's time to take you back to the ward," suggested Kristin. "We can't afford to have you catching a cold. We can always try again tomorrow."
"Whatever you say," said Harry, relieved she didn't ask any more questions.
After she'd tucked him up like a mother putting a young child to bed, he quickly fell into a deep sleep. Harry managed 11 laps of the deck the day before the Kansas Star sailed into New York Harbor. Although he couldn't admit it to anyone, he was quite excited about the prospect of seeing America for the first time.
"Will you be going straight back to Bridgeport once we've docked?" asked Kristin during his final lap, "or are you planning to stay in New York?"
"Haven't given it a lot of thought," said Harry, who had in fact given it a great deal of thought.
"I suppose it will depend on what time we dock,"
he added as he tried to anticipate her next question.
"It's just that if you'd like to spend the night at Richard's apartment on the east side, that would be swell."
"Oh, I wouldn't want to put him to any trouble." Kristin laughed.
"You know, Tom, there are times when you sound more like an Englishman than an American."
"I guess after all those years serving on British ships, you're bound to eventually get corrupted by the Limas."
"Is that also the reason you felt unable to share your problem with us?"
Harry came to a sudden halt. A stumble or a sneeze wasn't going to rescue him this time.
"If you'd been just a little more frank in the first place, we'd have been happy to sort out the problem. But given the circumstances, we had no choice but to inform Captain Parker and leave him to decide what should be done."
Harry collapsed into the nearest deck chair, but as Kristin made no attempt to come to his rescue, he knew he was beaten.
"It's far more complicated than you realize," he began, "but I can explain why I didn't want to involve anyone else."
"No need to," said Kristin. "The captain's already come to our rescue. But he did want to ask how you intended to deal with the bigger problem."
Harry bowed his head.
"I'm willing to answer any questions the captain might have," he said, feeling almost a sense of relief that he'd been found out.
"Like the rest of us, he wanted to know how you're going to get off the ship when you don't have any clothes or a dime to your name."
Harry smiled.
"I figured New Yorkers might consider a Kansas Star dressing gown to be pretty nifty. Frankly, not too many New Yorkers would notice even if you did walk down Fifth Avenue in a robe," said Kristin. "And the ones that did would probably think it was the latest fashion. But just in case they don't, Richard's come up with a couple of white shirts and a sports jacket. Pity he's so much taller than you, otherwise he'd have been able to supply a pair of pants as well. Dr. Wallace can spare a pair of brown wingtips, a pair of socks, and a tie."
"That still leaves us with the problem of the pants. But the captain has a pair of Bermuda shorts that no longer fit him."
Harry burst out laughing. We hope you won't be offended, Tom. But we also had a little collection among the crew, she added, passing him a thick envelope. I think you'll find there's more than enough to get you to Connecticut.
How do I begin to thank you? Said Harry.
No need to, Tom. We're all so pleased you survived. I only wish we could have saved your friend, Harry Clifton, as well. Still, you'll be glad to hear that Captain Parker has instructed Dr. Wallace to deliver your letter to his mother, personally.
Chapter 56 Harry was among the first on deck that morning, some 2 hours before the Kansas Star was due to sail into New York Harbor. It was another 40 minutes before the sun joined him, by which time he'd worked out exactly how he was going to spend his first day in America. He had already said farewell to Dr. Wallace, after trying, inadequately, to thank him for all he'd done. Wallace assured him that he would post his letter to Mrs. Clifton just as soon as he arrived in Bristol, and had reluctantly accepted that it might not be wise to visit her after Harry had hinted that she was of a nervous disposition. Harry was touched when Captain Parker called into the sick bay to deliver a pair of Bermuda shorts and wish him luck. After he had returned to the bridge, Kristin said firmly, "It's time for you to go to bed, Tom. You'll need all your strength if you're going to travel to Connecticut tomorrow." Tom Bradshaw would have liked to spend a day or two with Richard and Kristin in Manhattan, but Harry Clifton couldn't afford to waste any time now that Britain had declared war on Germany. "When you wake up in the morning," continued Kristin, "try to get up onto the passenger deck before first light. Then you can watch the sun rising as we sail into New York. I know you'll have seen it many times before, Tom, but it never fails to excite me."
"Me too," said Harry.
"And once we've docked," continued Kristin, "why don't you wait for Richard and me to come off duty, and then we can disembark together?"
Dressed in Richard's sports jacket and shirt, a little too large, the captain's Bermuda shorts, a little too long, and the doctor's shoes and socks, a little too tight, Harry couldn't wait to go ashore. The ship's purser had telegraphed ahead to advise the New York Immigration Department that they had an extra passenger on board, an American citizen called Tom Bradshaw. The NYID had telegraphed back to say that Mr. Bradshaw should make himself known to one of the immigration officials, and they would take it from there. Once Richard had dropped him off at Grand Central, Harry planned to hang around in the station for a little while before heading back to the docks, where he intended to report straight to the Union office and find out which ships were due to sail for England. It didn't matter which port they were heading for, as long as it wasn't Bristol. Once he had identified a suitable vessel, he would sign up for any job on offer. He didn't care if he worked on the bridge or in the boiler room, scrubbed the decks, or peeled potatoes, just as long as he got back to England. If there turned out to be no jobs available, he would book the cheapest passage home. He'd already checked the contents of the bulky white envelope Kristin had given him, and there was more than enough to pay for a berth that couldn't be smaller than the broom cupboard he'd slept in on the Devonian. It saddened Harry that when he returned to England, he wouldn't be able to contact any of his old friends, and he'd have to be cautious even when he got in touch with his mother. But the moment he stepped ashore, his only purpose would be to join one of His Majesty's warships and enlist in the fight against the King's enemies, even though he knew that whenever that ship returned to port, he would have to remain on board like a criminal on the run. Harry's thoughts were interrupted by a lady. He gazed in admiration when he first saw the Statue of Liberty looming up in front of him through the early morning mist. He had seen photographs of the iconic landmark, but they had not given a true sense of her size as she towered above the Kansas Star, welcoming visitors, immigrants, and her fellow countrymen to the United States. As the ship continued on its way towards the harbor, Harry leant over the railings and looked towards Manhattan, disappointed that the skyscrapers didn't appear to be any taller than some of the buildings he remembered in Bristol. But then, as each minute passed, they grew and grew until they appeared to soar up into the heavens, and he had to shade his eyes from the sun as he stared up at them. A New York Port Authority tugboat came out to join them and guided the Kansas Star safely to its berth on Number 7 dock. When Harry saw the cheering crowds, he began to feel apprehensive for the first time, even though the young man who was sailing into New York that morning was far older than the fourth officer who'd left Bristol only 3 weeks earlier. "Smile, Tom." Harry turned to see Richard looking down into a Kodak Brownie box camera. He was peering at an upside-down image of Tom with the Manhattan skyline as a backdrop. "You'll be one passenger I sure won't forget in a hurry," said Kristin, as she walked across to join him so that Richard could take a second photograph of them together. She had exchanged her nurse's uniform for a smart polka-dot dress, white belt, and white shoes. "Nor me you," said Harry, hoping that neither of them could sense how nervous he was. "Time for us to go ashore," said Richard, closing the shutter of his camera. The three of them took the wide staircase down to the lower deck, where several passengers were already streaming off the ship to be reunited with relieved relatives and anxious friends. As they made their way down the gangway, Harry's spirits were lifted by how many of the ship's passengers and crew wanted to shake him by the hand and wish him luck. Once they'd stepped onto the dockside, Harry, Richard, and Kristin headed towards immigration, where they joined one of four long queues. Harry's eyes darted about in every direction, and he wanted to ask so many questions. But any one of them would have revealed that this was the first time he'd set foot in America. The first thing that struck him was the patchwork quilt of different colors that made up the American people. He'd only ever seen one black man in Bristol, and remembered stopping to stare at him. Old Jack had told him it was both rude and inconsiderate, adding, "How would you feel if everyone stopped to stare at you just because you were white?" But it was the noise, the bustle, and the sheer pace of everything around him that most caught Harry's imagination and made Bristol seem as if it were languishing in a bygone age. He was already beginning to wish that he'd accepted Richard's offer to stay with him overnight, and perhaps spend a few days in a city he was finding so exciting even before he'd left the dockside. "Why don't I go through first?" said Richard, as they reached the head of the queue. "Then I can pick up my car and meet you both outside the terminal."
"Good idea," said Kristin.
"Next," shouted an immigration officer. Richard walked up to the desk and handed over his passport to the official, who glanced briefly at the photo before stamping it. "Welcome home, Lieutenant Tibbet."
"Next."
Harry stepped forward, uncomfortably aware that he had no passport, no identification, and someone else's name.
"My name's Tom Bradshaw," he said, with a confidence he didn't feel. "I think the purser of the SS Kansas Star telegraphed ahead to warn that I would be coming ashore."
The immigration officer looked closely at Harry, then picked up a sheet of paper and began to study a long list of names. Finally, he put a tick by one before turning round and nodding. For the first time, Harry noticed two men standing on the other side of the barrier, wearing identical grey suits and grey hats. One of them gave him a smile. The immigration officer stamped a piece of paper and handed it to Harry.
"Welcome back, Mr. Bradshaw. It's been a long time."
"Sure has," said Harry.
"Next!"
"I'll wait for you," said Harry, as Kristin made her way to the desk.
"I'll only be a moment," she promised. Harry passed through the barrier and entered the United States of America for the first time. The two men in grey suits stepped forward. One of them said,
"Good morning, sir. You Mr. Thomas Bradshaw?"
"That's me,"
said Harry. The words were hardly out of his mouth before the other man grabbed him and pinned his arms behind his back, while the first man handcuffed him. It all happened so quickly that Harry didn't even have time to protest. He remained outwardly calm, as he had already considered the possibility that someone might work out that he wasn't Tom Bradshaw, but in fact an Englishman called Harry Clifton. Even so, he had assumed that the worst they could do was serve him with a deportation order and have him shipped back to Britain. And as that was exactly what he'd planned to do anyway, he didn't put up a fight. Harry spotted two cars waiting by the sidewalk. The first was a black police car, with its back door being held open by another unsmiling man in a grey suit. The second was a red sports car, with Richard sitting on the bonnet, smiling. The moment Richard saw that Tom had been handcuffed and was being led away, he leapt up and began to run towards him. At the same time, one of the police officers began to read Mr. Bradshaw his rights, while the other continued to grip Harry firmly by the elbow.
"You have the right to remain silent. Anything you say can and will be used against you in a court of law. You have the right to an attorney."
A moment later, Richard was striding by their sides. He glared at the officers and said, "What the hell do you think you're doing?"
"If you cannot afford an attorney, one will be appointed to you," continued the first policeman, while the other ignored him. "Do you understand these rights as they have been read to you?"
"Yes, I do," said Harry calmly. Richard was clearly amazed by how relaxed Tom appeared, almost as if he wasn't surprised to have been arrested. But he was still determined to do anything he could to assist his friend. He leapt forward and blocked the officer's path and said firmly, "What are you charging Mr. Bradshaw with, officer?" The senior detective came to a halt, looked Richard in the eye, and said, "First-degree murder."
That is the end of Only Time Will Tell. It was written by Jeffrey Archer and read by Roger Allam and Amelia Fox. This has been an Isis Audiobooks presentation. Other titles from Isis by this author include Paths of Glory, Cain and Abel, and Thereby Hangs a Tale. For further details of our extensive catalogue of audiobooks on cassette, CD and MP3, please call our free phone number 0800 731 5637, or visit our website, www.isis-publishing.co.uk.